It's great to meet a lot of people who I know of and to meet people who are brand new to me and thinking about the work here. I've always been jealous of what Eric has been able to do with the animal studies network here. I wish we could do more of that in the States, but there's an advantage to being compact, I suppose, as opposed to being really kind of gigantic. The stuff I want to talk about today is a mix of a number of different projects kind of at once, so I apologize for its kind of scattershot nature in moments. Part of it is part of a new book project I'm doing about the making and taking of animal life in the 19th century. It'll be kind of another academic book project. And part of it is for a largely undergraduate-geared kind of textbook in terms of thinking about nature and culture in America and the relationship, in particular in my fields, between American studies and environmental history and animal studies. So it's kind of a little mess, a little bit, in some sense about that. So hopefully it won't be too chaotic. And let me set my timer, because I'm worried about Erica's official clock there, how that works. So I'll begin with a picture, maybe of just me and a pig. There we go. Can't go wrong with pig time. So back in 2007, I attended the Pork Industry Forum in Anaheim, California, and I told the organizers of that forum that I was writing a book on the relationship between humans and pigs, and I wanted to make sure I was getting the industry's perspective on the major relationship that Americans have with pigs, eating them. I attended a couple days of seminars, a highlight of which was the announcement by the vice president of Smithfield Foods that his company was going to phase out the use of gestation crates within a decade. Smithfield Foods is the largest single producer of pork in the United States, and its Tar Heel packing plant in North Carolina can slaughter and process up to 32,000 hogs per day. So Smithfield's decision to move away from this industry standard method of confining pregnant sows in metal barred and concrete floored cages that prevent them from turning around was truly newsworthy. It received praise from groups such as the Humane Society of the United States and Farm Sanctuary. Interestingly, Smithfield clawed that back about a year later, so it's an ongoing kind of saga in the States. Smithfield's initiative came after voters in Arizona in November 2006 approved Proposition 204, the Humane Treatment of Farm Animals Act, and that banned gestation crates and veal stalls by a wide margin, despite a very expensive industry campaign that failed, interestingly, that argued, quote, Proposition 204 is hogwash. That evening during happy hour, before the conference dinner at the hotel in Anaheim, I got to look at all the items up for bid at the members' auction. This is not one of them. This is a painting by the American vernacular artist Jenny Sell from 1955 called Butchering Day, but similar in style to a lot of the stuff I saw there. And many of the images at the auction were of individual pigs or of family farms. Many of them were patriotic in nature. I wish I'd taken more pictures of like the American flag with pigs in front of it that they had for sale there. And almost everything, whether paintings, quilts, or sculptures, stood in stark contrast to the reality of the industry that I heard that day. These auctioned items conjured up a time when farmers knew their pigs as individuals, but in talking to producers, which is the word that's largely replaced farmers these days, they spoke of having hundreds, if not thousands, of pigs, most kept in confinement systems, and most raised under contracting arrangements. In other words, most of these farmers didn't own the pigs that they were raising, or raising them under a contracting arrangement. It seemed appropriate that the National Pork Board and the National Pork Producers Council held their business meetings adjacent to Disneyland, for the self-presentation of themselves evinced a powerful manufactured nostalgia for the rural past, one at odds with the reality of the modern pig and pork industry. After all, who would want to make, much less bid upon, a handmade quilt featuring stitched squares of large heated barns where visitors have to wear protective clothing to maintain biosecurity, or a painting of a porcine genetics lab, or a sculpture of a sow and her piglets in a farrowing crate. This contrast between the reality of pork production in the 21st century and the traditional imagery to which pork producers, and for that matter much of the public, still cling, provided a key moment for me in thinking through the ideas and material that would become my 2011, hard to believe it's that old now, book, Pig, which is supposed to be pink, not blue. There's something wrong with the picture there. Which argued that pigs had been structurally and symbolically significant in the making of human culture around the globe, and that recent transformations in the way pork is produced have unfortunately severed many of the historical connections between humans and pigs. Humans' power over nature in general, and pigs in particular, is made possible in part by our belief in the separation of nature and culture. Seeing nature as outside of human culture and therefore subject to human control creates instrumental attitudes towards animals, bolsters human exceptionalism, and makes it hard to see the many ways in which humans and animals are deeply entangled. We often think of the natural world as essential, elemental, and outside of human culture, but the very act of eating and the history of our modification of both plants and animals for human use should remind us that we are all complicatedly enmeshed with an always already encultured nature, even if we cannot see or choose to not see that connection. Questions of visibility and invisibility and the broader politics of transparency will be the focus of much of my talk today, which looks at selected aspects of the human pig and human meat relationship, primarily in American culture. I'd be curious to know whether some of these trends are true here as well. Our control over non-human animals, of course, is both material and symbolic. It depends upon our power and technology, as well as the stories we tell and the cultural frames we apply to the human-animal relationship. Domination also depends on what we see, or more appropriately, what we wish to and or are allowed to see, as what is visible or invisible shapes both our knowledge of and practices toward non-human nature. However, there's no clear or single relation between the politics of sight and the status of animals in contemporary America. Although the invisibility and marginalization of animals involved in meat production is the norm, and the stories and representations essential to the functioning of industrial agriculture are almost uniformly nostalgic and traditional, that has not always been the case. Farmers and meat processors, as we'll see today, have often sought greater visibility to demonstrate how modern and progressive their means of production were. Spectacles of meat production and consumption have also marked moments of transformation and have helped sell meat in an increasingly consumer-centered culture. Many of these contemporary images and stories about animals and meat work to enable us to imagine that the connection between pigs and people is not as distant and alienated as it actually is. Few Americans today have direct encounters or experiences with living pigs. This distancing, combined with the multiple ways in which we consume the cultural pig or the idea of the pig, obscures the lives and deaths of actual pigs and reinscribes the separation of nature and culture. And perhaps the best place to see this is in Los Angeles, I argue. At this place, this is in Southern California, a center of American image making. We're in the industrial city of Vernon, suburbs, basically not really a suburb because no one lives there, it's just factories. In Los Angeles, one can find happy and healthy pigs frolicking in an idyllic setting. Some are lazing on the grass in the sun, others are drinking from a stream or eating at a trough. A buxom country girl bursting out of her clothes leads a pig on a rope. Calling to mind the oft-used phrase, when pigs fly, another pig is decked out in sunglasses and a baseball cap, I forgot to bring that image, piloting a small plane, towing a banner featuring the logo of the Farmer John brand, family-owned since 1931. These pigs are the stars of these murals here, painted by Les Grimes between 1957 and 1968, when Grimes fell to his death while working on a portion of the sky in the background of the murals there. And these murals decorate the walls of the Clarity Meatpacking Company plant in Vernon, California. And the contradiction between these murals, with their nostalgic representations of individual pigs happy in the countryside, and the mass killing of pigs that takes place inside this labor-intensive factory in the industrial urban landscape, should come as no surprise. In fact, the activist artist Sue Coe has brought this tension to the surface in several of her paintings and drawings, which focus on the intertwined suffering of the immigrant human laborers and the non-human animals at Farmer John's. Sue Coe had trouble accessing Farmer John's for her project, and today access to the site is made even more difficult by the complete prohibition of parking around the plant and in the lot of the McDonald's conveniently located across the street, where, at the right time, the time is right, one can order the McRib sandwich, another simulation, this time of the actual ribs of a pig manufactured out of pressed pork shoulder meat and drenched in barbecue sauce. And I noticed by looking up McRib that McRib is returning to the UK later this summer, in case you're excited about that. There's a long story we can talk about later, perhaps, about how McDonald's basically runs a gigantic arbitrage market in the futures of pork prices to decide when to reintroduce McRib. It's super interesting. But we'll save that for later. Les Grimes' murals of these contented pigs on the walls of Farmer John's slaughterhouse mark our complicated and ambivalent human attitudes about and practices towards pigs. They remind us of a human-pig relationship that was perhaps not so distant or as alienated as it is in the industrialized world today, even though that relationship has always been framed by and centered on the killing of pigs by humans. Today, of course, this killing for meat and other products derived from animals' bodies takes place on an unimaginable scale. Hundreds of millions of pigs are killed yearly throughout the globe for food. And this time of year, usually in the United States, the slaughter numbers are coming in at about 420,000 to 440,000 a day. The raising and killing of pigs is invisible to most Americans. In fact, this invisibility, that's not invisibility, that's a nice pig defense, is crucial to the functioning of the industrial agricultural system that produces the vast majority of meat that Americans consume, and to the maintenance and naturalization of our power over non-human animals in nature. Although the relationship between visibility and power can be tracked in a number of realms of American life, most notably the prison system that dominates my state of California at the expense of higher education, it may perhaps be most clearly seen in the largely unacknowledged lives and deaths of food animals. More than 9 billion land animals are raised and killed for food annually in the United States. The production of meat thus is accordingly an aspect of the human-animal relationship, where, as Anat Pick has noted, relations of power operate in their exemplary purity, that is, operate with the fewest moral or material obstacles. So the remainder of my talk today, I'd like to look at two moments, one historical, one contemporary, when spectacles of meat consumption and production have worked to normalize transitions in food production. In the first instance, a promise of abundant meat for the growing nation was linked to the visibility of the animal body in an effort to promote new ways of raising, killing, and distributing meat. In the second, the mania for all things related to bacon works to break the connection between pigs and pork, occluding the workings of contemporary industrial agriculture. In both instances, the human-pig relationship sheds light on the entanglements of nature and culture in America, a complexity that's often hard to see given how our tendency to think in binary terms, nature, culture, human, animal, itself contributes to the politics of invisibility that has been central to the development of a meat industrial complex that profoundly affects humans, animals, and the environment. So part one will be a meat spectacular, celebrating butchers in the slaughterhouse. Got what a pig parade up there. In the early 19th century, when Americans in urban areas had a closer yet still instrumental relationship to their food animals, a public spectacle marked new ways of raising and butchering livestock. The Grand Procession of the Victualers, seen here, that took place in Philadelphia on March 15, 1821, along with subsequent efforts to promote modern methods of producing meat, highlight changes to the complicated relationship between farmers, butchers, and consumers. In December 1820, residents of Philadelphia started noticing advertisements in the papers calling their attention to a cattle show to be held in the new year that would feature animals of the finest breed, fattened by farmers in the regions around Philadelphia. By early March 1821, William White, a prominent butcher and civic booster, was advertising an exhibition of these superior bred animals outside of his slaughterhouse on Front Street. According to the press, thousands of spectators witnessed this display of the successful efforts of progressive farmers to improve livestock breeds. Given the contemporary vogue for improvement of farm animals in Europe and the United States, something I'm writing about in this other book project of mine, this exhibition itself was not particularly remarkable. But what made the Philadelphia event stand out, however, was the killing of all of these animals by William White and his brother victualers to make possible a 2-mile procession of 86,731 pounds of meat from 63 cattle, 42 oxen, 4 bears, 3 deer, 10 goats, 8 giant hogs, and numerous sheep. And this is the lithograph of the meat parade. So this meat parade included more than 200 butchers mounted on fine horses. So the butchers got to ride these horses in the front, dressed in white frocks and sashes. And they were separated from the product of their labor, which was loaded onto carts and driven by boys in white frocks with artificial flowers and gay ribbons. This spectacular procession drew crowds of tens of thousands. It was praised in the press and was commemorated in first a drawing and then this print based on a watercolor by John Lewis Krimmel. And one of the interesting things is this is one of the animals that they slaughtered and they remounted it. And this man here, his name is Tuffy is his name. And he was rotating the head back and forth. So as the float went by, kind of turning it so it could kind of look at the various spectators. I've learned a lot of weird things about some of these characters in this kind of print here. More about that later, perhaps. As the art historian Alexander Nemiroff has noted, both the meat parade and prints of it that were created through the 1860s served to dramatize and even create the respectable professional identity of the city's victualers. And they're rebranding themselves, basically. This is the logo from the bottom of the print here, the new logo for the Philadelphia victualers. We feed the hungry, in this case. They're helping to celebrate, legitimize butchers and celebrate the men responsible for creating improved animals and the abundant meat that came from them, and all of the meat from these animals sold in just 14 hours on the day following the parade. This is a key moment in the killing of animals in American history, and I argue this meat parade perhaps marks the beginning of the disconnection of the people and their meat, as thousands of Philadelphians clearly reveled in the spectacle of killing and consumption on a grand scale, done for them by newly legitimate professionals heralding a new era of food processing. In Philadelphia, as urban middle-class Americans stopped raising and killing their own meat, the bodies of both animals and human laborers became, briefly, hyper-visible. So part of my project is about the broader effort to legitimize the butcher, which is a transnational project in the early 19th century, seen in texts like this one. This is published in London in 1816. This is the frontispiece to The Experienced Butcher. And all these books are intended to show the, quote, respectability and usefulness of his calling. And there are other American narratives as well. This is the frontispiece to Thomas DeVoe's 1863 The Market Book. And he was a butcher turned historian and is one of the great primary sources for what Americans ate in the middle parts of the 19th century. It's one of the two of the most remarkable books that you can ever possibly read, is DeVoe's Histories of Foodways in America, in this case. You can also see this effort to legitimize the butcher in model butcher shops that have been subject to debate over their intended audience. This is a British version of that model butcher shop, but there are American ones as well. Are they, as historian Robert Culf argues, children's toys from an era when young people would have had a closer relationship to the sources of their meat, or were they instead created as advertisements to be displayed in a butcher shop's window so you know what the shop is about? There's a debate among historians about what these are. Culf suggests in that debate that these were actually children's toys. They're popular toys, as children enjoy taking down and wrapping Sunday joints for one's brothers and sisters. And presumably a certain amount about the prime cuts of meat was learned painlessly by doing it. And I love some of the details in this. They usually, almost all of these models are beautiful. I'm going to try to see one in London next week. It's the V&A. They have like bloody sawdust covered floors. It's really, they're really kind of remarkably detailed. So I'm trying to figure out more about these models. I think these models reflect the emergence of the retail butcher shop itself as an urban site and site. So a site, something you look at in a location. And like the Victualler's Parade, here's some butcher stalls, some reformed butcher stalls, 1870s, Philadelphia. They exemplify how making meat visible is connected to structural changes surrounding the production and consumption of meat. The creation of new public perceptions of livestock, butchers, and butcher shops through these models and spectacles that seem unusual today were in the 19th century, I suggest, both a reminder and a prediction of the victualler's ability to provide plentiful meat to the American public through improvements in agriculture and meat processing. These improvements continued throughout the 19th century, both to animals' bodies, which I won't talk about today, and to the production and distribution of meat. After all, the 19th century also saw the rise of the slaughterhouse, a centralized system for turning animals into meat that was seen as the epitome of the civilized and the modern. Here's one of the contemporary updated Philadelphia packing establishments, specializing in pork. Developments in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the first half of the 19th century heralded the modern pork industry, as entrepreneurs pioneered the use of mass production techniques in their famous disassembly line that turned pigs into pork. And this is a lovely lithograph of pork packing in Cincinnati, the entire process, killing, cutting, rendering, salting, etc. In this case, visitors to Cincinnati, soon named Porkopolis for the hundreds of thousands of pigs that were driven to and processed in the city, marveled at this new world of animal industry. I'll have a long quote here from Frederick Law Olmsted, the journalist and landscape architect, when he visited Cincinnati in 1857. This is an early account of a related part of my project of what I'm calling meat tourism. Here's the quote from Olmsted. "We entered an immense low-ceiled room and followed a vista of dead swine upon their backs, their paws stretching mutely toward heaven. Walking down to the vanishing point, we found there a sort of human chopping machine where the hogs were converted into commercial pork. A plank table, two men to lift and turn, two to wield the cleavers, were its component parts. No iron cog wheels could work with more regular motion. Plump falls the hog upon the table. Chop, 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 fall the cleavers. All is over. But before you can say so, plump, chop, 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 sounds again. There is no pause for admiration. By a skilled sleight of hand, hams, shoulders, clear, mess, and prime fly off, each squarely cut to its own place, where attendants aided by trucks and dumbwaiters dispatch each to its separate destiny. Amazed beyond all expectation at the celerity, we took out our watches and counted 35 seconds from the moment when one hog touched the table until the next occupied its place. The number of blows required, I regret we did not count. The vast slaughter yards we took occasion not to visit, satisfied at seeing the rivers of blood that flowed from them." End of quote. Thanks to the railroads, the technology of ice packing, and the centralizing forces unleashed by the Civil War, Chicago replaces Cincinnati as the nation's pork processing center, serving as the hog butcher for the world. Unlike in Cincinnati, where processors were scattered throughout the city, post-war meat processing in Chicago was centralized on the south side at the famous Union Stockyards, separating the production of meat from urban life. While residents and visitors to Cincinnati were shocked at the number of hogs in the city, Francis Trollope famously remarked, quote, "I am sure I would have liked Cincinnati much better if the people had not dealt so very largely in hogs," unquote. In Chicago, the stockyards and processing plants themselves became a tourist destination. An indication of the appeal of a visit to the slaughterhouse can be found in a folder produced in 1903 by Swift & Company. This visitor's reference book served as, quote, "a souvenir of a visit to the plant of Swift & Company in Chicago, Illinois, and as a reminder of the modern methods and activities of the American meatpacking industry," unquote. This illustrated pamphlet provided facts about the size of Swift's operations, including the amount of meat produced, and emphasized the close scrutiny by both Swift and government inspectors of both the animals in the stockyards and the meat produced from their bodies for the public. The tour of the plant and the depictions of it included in this souvenir enabled the public to observe the conversion of animals into meat. From the visitor's entrance, where the real sightseeing begins, to the loading platform where dressed meat was shipped to every part of the known world. A particular note are the images of the transformation of living pigs into pork, remarkable in their depiction here of a well-dressed family observing the hog pens and witnessing the killing of pigs. Deaths enabled by, quote, the skilled dispatcher who starts 800 an hour, and you can note the change in time from homestead to Swift to contemporary slaughterhouses, on the journey through the dressing and cleaning rooms to the vast coolers. Today's viewer, this drawing of this little girl playing on the rail in front of the kill line is quite remarkable, for it's virtually impossible to imagine that level of interest in, much less access to, today's processing plants. As far as I've been able to tell, no contemporary slaughterhouse offers public tours. In fact, much of what we know about the meat industrial complex, as we know, comes from journalists and activists who have successfully and usually surreptitiously infiltrated these operations. So one of the questions I'm thinking about in the first part of this project today is how to account for this transformation. When did the killing of animals and the processing of meat become largely invisible? As we have seen, slaughterhouses were to some degree publicly accessible and promoted themselves as such for much of the 19th and 20th centuries, marking the pride that meatpacking companies took in their modern technologies that put food on American tables. Producers turned the production of meat into a marketing opportunity, and through both factory tours and product advertising, encouraged Americans to consume both meat and the spectacle of its production at a moment marked by the expansion of industrial capitalism and increased competition for urban consumers. This is the Swift booth at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Through at least the early part of the 20th century, production and consumption were intertwined as what would become known as factory farming, meant initially something positive. The wrong picture, we'll keep that there. The triumph of industrial agricultural engineering and the concomitant glorification of new and more efficient means of production that reduced prices increased availability for consumers. While farmers and meat producers still take pride in their efficiency and their ability to feed more and more people, their means of production are much harder to see given the changes to the relationship between consumers and their food. Shifting public sensibilities, linked in part to transformations during the post-war period that saw both the growth of animal welfare and animal rights movements, concerns about the environment and sustainability, and the passage of laws like the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958, have made factory farming today a term that raises consumer concern. Just like a century of food literature has gone from Upton Sinclair's factory and labor center, The Jungle, to Eric Schlosser's consumer-centered Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. Increasingly, and interestingly, environmental consciousness and consumer concern about the ethics and implications of food production in the post-World War II era have coincided with a steady decrease in public access to food production, a distancing between animals and meat, and the almost complete disappearance of these living animals from our everyday lives. The second part today is the cultural work of bacon mania. Pork consumption in the U.S. has long been a useful lens into race, region, and class. And you see this in this late 19th century image here of different parts of pigs and the argument of which groups like them, particularly the sense that African Americans like chitlins and certain parts of the pig. The British, of course, like this part very much. But what I would argue in this section of the paper is that the recent bacon mania, if you want to call it that, that's what I'm calling it, is as much cultural as it is culinary. It's worth the attention of animal studies scholars and activists because it highlights both our successes and challenges in changing attitudes about and practices involving the production and killing of pigs. While many of us here are likely not consumers of bacon at all, although I am curious about people's thoughts about vegetarian and vegan bacon substitutes, some of which are on this slide here, and also about the often cited claim that bacon is kryptonite or a gateway drug that lures vegetarians and vegans back to meat. You hear this all the time. I'm curious about that. I would like to suggest that it's still worth thinking about what bacon signifies in our late capitalist, social media-driven consumer culture. Bacon production and consumption, and what I like to call the bacon culture, that largely erases production and celebrating consumption, serves as a useful way into a number of issues in contemporary American culture, including factory farming, animal exploitation, and environmental destruction on the production side, and the implications of meat eating structured by race, gender, class, and on individual and public health on the consumer side, in that sense. I won't be able to talk about all of this today, of course, in the remainder of my time, but hopefully most of those issues are familiar to this audience. Instead, I would like to talk a little bit about how bacon has become so ubiquitous, about how the celebration of bacon reflects and produces ideas about class and gender, and how this bacon mania ultimately works to make pigs disappear behind their end products, furthering the distance between human and non-human animals in the production of meat. I'd like to suggest that we need to combat the cultural erasure of the fact that bacon is pigs, contesting the culture of meat and the backlash against vegetarianism and veganism at the level of consumption as well as production. This is the Bacon and Beer Festival. It's a popular summertime event in the United States these days. We're going to ask if you guys know who these two characters are. Most of us do. Okay, good. I was worried about that. In Pig, I wrote about the renewed interest in pigs and pork in the American culinary community and in American popular culture. Unbeknownst to most, however, the celebration of pork in modern America is not a new thing. It has sustained and substantial historical roots. In the 19th century, pork consumption was so prevalent that Dr. John Wilson of Columbus, Georgia wrote, quote, "The United States of America might properly be called the Great Hog-Eating Confederacy or the Republic of Porkdom," unquote. He noted, quote, "So far as meat is concerned, it is fat bacon and pork only, and that continually, morning, noon, and night, for all classes, sexes, ages, and conditions," unquote. And in fact, pork was America's number one meat for years and years. It's now third on the list, although there's some thought that pork might pass beef in American consumption terms in 2017 or 2018, which is a very interesting development. Connections between Americans and pork, between pork and the nation, in this case, were made visible in this, I love this image, this is the Porcinograph, a good cheer souvenir for the American centennial in 1876, a map of the United States in the shape of a pig. I like the fact that Cuba's a little sausage down there, in that case. And in an 1884 map, nicknames of the states that used pigs to illustrate the various kind of characters of residents of particular states of the United States. In the U.S. today, pork consumption is third in per capita consumption, behind chicken and beef, in part because of health concerns about pork, but mainly because of the success of factory farming and making chicken more accessible and less expensive. Pork was especially demonized in the 1980s, and the industry responded. I don't know if they had this campaign in the UK at all, but this was the big American campaign for years. The industry responded by turning pork into chicken, by basically reverse engineering pigs to make pork less like a red meat, which pork is, and rebranding it here at, oops, wrong button, as the other white meat, in the face of 4% annual declines in pork consumption. Interestingly, pork has rebounded in part because of the success of the industry in rebranding its products. And my favorite version of this happened 2 years ago at the World Pork Expo, when, in fact, I was there, and so I became kind of the jerk in the room who raised the question, you guys made pork into chicken in the 1980s, and now in the 2010s, you're making it back into steak. These were the way they renamed pork cuts to make them reflect the cuts of beef, right? T-bone, ribeye, New York, and porterhouse. It's a really interesting shift from pork being chicken to pork being steak, not in that case. And then pork has also rebounded because of the success of the industry in getting more pork products, especially bacon, into meals. The food service industry helped fuel the recent bacon craze. I'll come back to bacon in a month, though. The recent bacon craze, in part by adding the product to dishes and meals where it had not been eaten before. Restaurants use bacon as an ingredient because of its high flavor profile. In fact, according to David Kessler, author of a book called The End of Overeating, one standard line in the restaurant business is, quote, "When in doubt, throw cheese and bacon on it," unquote. Pork producers are trying to extend bacon consumption to other day parts, that's the term the industry uses, other day parts as they call them, in both restaurant and pre-cooked meals, hoping to expand Americans' eating of bacon beyond breakfast, or as a supplemental ingredient in green beans or as a pizza topping. Disturbing retail innovations have been important here. I don't have pictures of them, thankfully, especially the development and marketing of pre-cooked bacon, perhaps the ultimate convenience meat, and flavored bacon products. Today's bacon renaissance is highly, a renaissance in pork in general, is highly gendered and classed. National Pork Board research indicates that men are the dominant purchasers and consumers of pork. And anecdotally, most of the drivers of interest in pork in restaurants and in social media have been men. Bacon mania also serves as an index to social class. At the high end, numerous websites such as the Bacon of the Month Club and blogs promote artisanal varieties of bacon and ham. And several restaurants specialize in pigs and pork, including Donald Link's Cochon in New Orleans. There are several pork-based cookbooks as well that have become very popular in the United States. Middle and upper class foodies delight in procuring and consuming often quite expensive heirloom pork products, including bacon that is slow cured in traditional ways that are now marginal to the way pork is generally produced. Here's an image of some high-end hams being cured. In contrast, the bacon celebrated as part of Bacon Mania is not artisanal, but it's an industrial product that can be produced in a modern pork processing plant in a matter of hours, with wet curing and vein pumping long ago replacing this method of dry curing of hams and bacon. The standard supermarket bacon emerged first in the 1920s and became a staple of family breakfasts. In fact, bacon is still largely eaten as a breakfast food. The average American will have bacon 18 times per year, just over 2/3 of that as strips at breakfast. Some have argued that bacon's appeal is tied to its status as a comfort food, one many of us remember from childhood. And this makes me think a lot of Guy's talk yesterday. Others have claimed there's something unique and compelling about the smell and taste of bacon, and indeed much research, both consumer and scientific, has been gone into studying how the salts, fats, and umami, a loan word from Japanese used to describe the pleasant, savory taste of some foods, that is itself tied to the industrial synthesis of MSG in the early part of the 20th century, of bacon, had made it such a popular food item and flavoring. While not discounting the appeal to many of the taste of bacon, a reminder of the challenges we face in positioning ethical concerns against real and perceived pleasures. And one of my concerns really is, how do we contest the presumption that deliciousness all too often trumps the human, animal, and environmental cost of meat? But it's my contention that the apparent current interest in all things bacon-related here is more cultural than culinary, and serves in part as a way to rebel against an increasingly health-conscious and politically correct society. Here's Colin Carroll Adams. Here on these. This is the party line in numerous articles and books that fuel bacon mania, chronicle and fuel bacon mania, decidedly overdetermined phenomenon. Aviva Shen suggests that, quote, putting bacon on everything or wearing it as lingerie is a statement of hedonism, pure and simple, a defiant stand against any movement that suggests we moderate what we eat, unquote. My favorite bacon costume are not those, but this. This guy won first prize at Covent Garden in 1894 for dressing as a side of bacon. And I like it in part because no one would know what that costume is anymore. No one knows what a side of bacon is, right? We know bacon as strips, but we don't know bacon as a side. And I think that's maybe the greatest costume of all time, right there, is how that works. Certainly many products by both the fast food industry and individual chefs reflect American gluttony at its worst. I'll give you some examples. Wendy's Baconator. Six strips of bacon atop a half-pound cheeseburger, or Jack in the Box's artificially flavored bacon milkshake. And homegrown inventions such as this, the Bacon Explosion, which is 2 pounds of bacon wrapped around 2 pounds of sausage and grilled. They're clearly a claim to masculinity, these products, a response to elite and effeminate foodie snobbery, and an assertion of democratic eating pleasures. As Sarah Heppola writes in the summary of this bacon mania, for many, quote, loving bacon is like shoving a middle finger in the face of all that is healthy and holy, while an unfiltered cigarette smolders between your lips, unquote. The analogy between smoking and eating bacon is an interesting one, one that's kind of well-drawn and kind of fascinating. Similarly, in their recently published book, Bacon Nation, Peter Kaminsky and Marie Rama argue that, quote, part of the current bacon craze is due, no doubt, to a social phenomenon that you might call good nutrition fatigue. Bacon obsession has become a way to proclaim our independence from the food police who would have us mostly eat a diet of boiled lentils and mashed yeast, unquote. And note here, of course, how the bacon advocates use the straw man argument, right, about what vegetarians and vegans actually eat, you know, albeit one that calls attention to the politics of pleasure in the debates about food and the erasure of the exploitation and killing of non-human animals in providing those pleasures. So most of us here are aware of this contours of this active and corporately supported pro-meat backlash. Something that you can actually view as an indicator of the success of proponents of human health, ecological sustainability, and animal liberation. This backlash also indexes the anxiety of consumers about their meat eating and the fears of those in and promoting animal agricultural industries that people might move away from their horrific products. Certainly for some of the celebrators of bacon, such overly demonstrative meat eating serves as a way of demonstrating that one is hyper-masculine, not politically correct, definitely not vegan or vegetarian, and certainly not concerned about the lives and deaths of pigs in the horrifying meat industrial complex. In fact, with the exception of foodies who are concerned about the organic and the antibiotic-free lives of heirloom breed pigs that end up as pork, the focus here is on a consumption of a meat distanced from the confined and invisible animals that are raised solely to be killed to produce meat. And one of the pictures I have here that's the only one I've ever found like this is a picture of a pig that's actually made to look marbled like bacon. Right? I mean, it testifies, the absence of this type of imagery, I think testifies to the way that bacon weirdly erases the pig. And it does so in another way. Weirdly, much of this obsession with bacon doesn't involve pigs and pork at all. There's countless bacon-themed and bacon-celebratory products in consumer culture. While conducting research in Iowa a couple years ago at one store alone, I saw almost 50 bacon-flavored or bacon-themed items for sale. Among the flavored items were bacon chocolate bar, gummy bacon, candy bacon, bacon salt, and cheddar bacon popcorn. Now, these edible novelties were eclipsed by an immense display of other items, including candles, air fresheners, magnets, keychains, earrings, t-shirts with slogans like bacon is meat candy, and bacon makes everything better, dish towels, adhesive bandages, there we go, gift wrap, iPhone cases, magnets, yay bacon, bacon-flavored toothpicks, bacon-flavored lip balm, and signs reading, I love you more than bacon. you are the bacon to my eggs. And again, the one they like here, bacon makes everything better. It should be apparent how bacon increasingly appears in places where one does not expect it, exceeding the boundaries of food while being literally detached and disembodied from pigs. Almost all of the bacon-flavored products on the market are distanced from the lives and deaths of pigs, thanks to the ability to chemically synthesize the flavor of bacon. I've been doing a lot of research on this lately. The ubiquity of these products is largely due to one company, Justin and Dave's Down Home Enterprises, a company whose motto is, quote, everything should taste like bacon, unquote. They sell a range of bacon-flavored salt and a bacon mayonnaise called, unsurprisingly, Baconaise, that the comedian Jon Stewart, hopefully you know Jon Stewart, described as the perfect product, quote, for people who want heart disease but are too lazy to actually make the bacon, unquote. Interestingly though, Baconaise is kosher and also vegan. There's no actual pork in these products. There's no actual animal products in these food items, largely because of the use of artificial bacon flavoring. Artificial bacon flavoring was perfected in the 1950s. Thanks to the efforts of the post-war flavor industry, and first reached popular acceptance through the popularity of Bakos, a food of the future, seen here, which made its national debut in May 1968, and according to a General Mills press release, quote, offered the ultimate inconvenience because there's no preparation required, and because they can be stored in the cupboard without refrigeration even after opening, unquote. Ever since the development of Bakos, which is a soy-based vegan product that's a reminder that corporate agriculture has often been at the vanguard in creating meat-free products, which is an interesting tension, I think, although the interests are more in shelf stability than replacing animal-derived products, bacon has been increasingly detached from actual pigs, perhaps most obviously in the recently announced Scope Bacon mouthwash. This turns out to have been, an internet hoax, which went viral, perpetuated by the Scope company to help raise consumer consciousness. Like the bra earlier, the top picture of the bra was actually a viral consumer product, as opposed to the woman on the bottom who actually made that bra and runs a website called baconcouture.com. In that case. And the worst development is actually not the mouthwash, get ready. This is the development by Justin and Dave of bacon-flavored personal lubricant that you can use with latex condoms down here at the bottom that are shaped and colored like strips of bacon. Right. I mean, it's kind of like you kind of wonder, like, everything about that is wrong. This extension of bacon into unrelated consumer products perhaps tells us more about viral marketing and our desire to celebrate the marginal and kitschy. But the hyper-visibility and over-determination of bacon, however cleverly presented, ultimately turns the lives of pigs and the production of production and consumption of meat into a joke. And in fact, bacon-flavored lube, the product here at the top, bacon lube, originally began as an April Fool's joke before enough people demanded that they actually make it. And then it became, started as kind of a joke and became a real consumer product. Same thing happened with the condoms. In this case. And ironically, these create further distance between humans and pigs that are, for some people, the sources of their food. Interestingly, now, industry statistics indicate that bacon mania has not had any appreciable effect on bacon consumption. There's not been a huge uptake in bacon consumption as a result of this, which has remained more or less constant. And interestingly, when I talk to some people in the industry about that, they have nothing to do with this. They're happy that it goes on, but they're not kind of secretly behind much of this kind of effort to promote bacon in the United States. It kind of really is a grassroots or corporate derived from other types of products like Scope and J&D's here, doing that type of stuff. But one of the things I find interesting is that the bacon meme in American culture runs an uncanny parallel to the promotion of anti-whistleblower laws in many states that have become to be known as ag gag laws. And these bills, which you may have heard of here in the UK, criminalize efforts to expose the conditions on factory farms and are promoted and supported by agribusiness interests in groups such as the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which produces model legislation for state legislatures. You can see here at the bottom a list of the various states that have proposed or passed these types of bills in this case. These laws are designed to make it difficult, if not impossible, for employees to expose the mistreatment of animals, the violation of labor laws, or environmental problems. And they criminalize undercover work and the taking of photography and videos at factory farms. Thankfully, most of these laws have failed to pass, thanks to outcry from animal activists, the general public, and journalists. Although the lack of transparency in our food system remains a major problem. As the food writer Mark Bittman put it, after all of his requests to visit food processors in Iowa were ignored or rejected, quote, when a journalist can't see how the food we eat is produced, you don't need ag gag laws, the system's already gagged, unquote. Industry efforts to promote these ag gag laws share the same belief in the politics of transparency that motivates activists, reminding us that the impulse to link sight and political transformation is strong. while making visible what we were doing to pigs and other farm animals, may promote a more humane and sustainable relationship to animals and nature. Many people still do not want to know how farm animals are raised and meat is produced. Or if they do know, they manage to compartmentalize this information to keep on consuming inexpensive and abundant meat. Moreover, some forms of visibility preserve as much as they critique the capacity to separate pigs from pork, or pigs from humans. Artisanal pork and bacon mania both obscure the long history of interconnections between our two species, relationships that have together produced both humanness and pigness on multiple levels. It's not just what pigs mean to us in our culture, but how we are all deeply enmeshed with animals, economically, politically, technologically, culturally, biologically, and historically. But the story of humans and pigs, then, both complicates how we codify, categorize, and connect life forms. What these stories suggest, I hope, is that thinking in binary and essentialist terms, pigs, humans, nature, culture, helps produce a politics of invisibility that obscures these connections and helps underwrite the meat industrial complex. Thanks.